think I'm just going to feel like I'm forgetting something until we're like a couple days in.
I think you're right, because I'm certainly feeling that way.
Yeah.
I'm Matt Podolsky. Back in the spring of 2022, I set out with my mom, Candy, to hike the entire length of the Appalachian Trail.
Pack feels pretty good.
Yeah.
How's yours feel?
It feels fine.
Yeah.
I guess we're in trouble if it doesn't feel good and we haven't even hiked it a single mile.
That wouldn't be good.
My mom and I had just been dropped off at Amicalola Falls State Park in Georgia. This is where many Appalachian Trail thru-hikers begin their journey. We were nervous, walking through the parking lot, searching for the registration center.
AT hiker registration? That way? There, but I know.
Huh. Well, let's go.
I guess we can ask, yeah.
This is where we register. Shelter 2, opposite side of the playground. Okay.
All right.
Thank you.
Okay.
The AT, as people call it, is managed by the Appalachian Trail Conservancy. They maintain a thru-hiker registry, and all thru-hikers are strongly encouraged to sign in before starting the hike. It's a little bureaucratic, but also a literal rite of passage.
All right, here we go.
Yeah.
27.6,
that's pretty good.
That's okay.
Yeah.
It's also a tradition to weigh one's pack as a part of the registration process. A lightweight pack is crucial for such a long hike, and my mom and I had carefully selected each item we brought with us.
Yours is much heavier. It's, okay, let's try it. It's so bad.
27, almost 28.
All right.
I'll call it 28.
Although many Appalachian Trail thru-hikers begin their journey from this exact spot, the trail itself begins at the summit of Springer Mountain. My mom and I snapped a quick photo under the famous stone archway that marks the start of the approach trail, the trail that takes you to the beginning of the trail. And we began our long walk.
Well, I just spent all day and made it to the beginning of the trail. It's nice up here.
It's beautiful.
Appalachian National Scenic Trail, Springer Mountain, elevation 3782, southern terminus. All right.
Well, that's awesome.
Yeah.
Every spring, several thousand people travel to northern Georgia to begin a long-distance trek that occupies a unique space in American culture. For some, walking nearly 2,200 miles from Georgia to Maine is a test of one's physical endurance. For others, it's an escape from the monotony of a desk job.
It seems that I've been looking for some big, epic adventure pretty much my whole life.
Many thru-hikers treat their journey as a way to heal from the grief of a loss or as a treatment for depression.
Doing an AT to get rid of the stress. I had a heart attack in October, had a stent put in.
The trail represents something different for each person who walks it, and more than 3 million people set foot on this path each year. For me, it represented blissful calm.
You're constantly surrounded by beauty.
And at other times, it represented frustration, fear, discomfort, and pain.
I don't ever remember experiencing slippery lichen like that. Oh, it was very stressful.
But this show is about more than the thru-hiker experience. It's about the connections between the trail and the people who walk along its path.
And I wanted to kind of experience the pain and suffering that my people went through during the removal.
It's about the ecosystems that encompass the length of this ancient mountain chain and how the trail has become their protector.
I would call the Appalachian Trail corridor in general a hot spot. You're going to see multiple timber rattlesnakes.
But above all else, this is a show about our complex human relationship with protected landscapes. This is Common Land. For me and my mom, this journey really started way back in 2013. Back then, we did our first big hike together, an end-to-end hike of Vermont's Long Trail.
So we made it.
We did.
It's the start of the trail. What do you think? You ready? Ready to hike 273 miles to Canada?
I have no idea. I'm gonna take it one day at a time.
It took us about a month to do it, but we needed that time to process something we were both going through. When we set out on that first hike, it had been just months since we lost my dad to cancer.
Do you remember me first proposing the idea of doing a long distance hike back when dad was sick?
I do. I remember it quite vividly. And I thought it was a fabulous idea. I had actually been thinking similar thoughts.
I mean, what is it about an experience like this that helps overcome grief?
I think that when you're out in the woods, you're with yourself. Even if you're hiking with somebody else, you spend a lot of time alone. And I found after your father died that I was constantly busy. I was looking for things to distract my mind from dealing with the difficulty of losing him. You couldn't do that on the trail. You had to deal with it. You had to think about it and to mourn and then to start thinking about how to heal.
Mm. What's our next hike going to be, Mom?
I don't know. Maybe we have to do the whole Appalachian Trail.
Nine years later, as we stood on the summit of Springer Mountain, that conversation felt like a distant memory. We were overwhelmed by the enormity of what lay ahead of us, but were also giddy with excitement at the prospect of spending 6 months living in the woods.
Well, how do you feel? We made it.
I feel great.
Yeah.
Yeah, here we are.
Yeah. And another plaque. A footpath for those who seek fellowship with the wilderness.
Oh, I see a white blaze.
Oh, yeah. First white blaze, yeah.
Wait, I have to get a picture of that.
Yeah.
The next 6 months of my life would be guided by white blazes. These small, white, rectangular blazes painted on trees mark the path of the Appalachian Trail. Although there are other hiking trails that are longer, the AT is the longest hiking-only footpath in the world, and the only to be regularly marked with these iconic white blazes. After a day or two of walking, my mom and I quickly settled into a routine. Wake up at sunrise, pack up, eat a bar or two, start walking. Walking became my job and my sole responsibility. All I had to worry about was the distance that I covered each day. I thought a lot about my wife and son back home in Idaho. I thought about my dad, imagining what he might think of our 2,200-mile-long trek. But I also thought a lot about the land that I was passing through. I've spent the past 15 years producing documentaries about the connections between humans and nature, and to me, the trail represented a laboratory for examining our relationship with the natural world. I knew from my research that the southernmost 635 miles of the trail fall within the former boundaries of the Cherokee Nation. Long before the word thru-hiker ever existed, people have been following footpaths all throughout these mountains.
When we were placed here, the Creator gave us our customs and our traditions.
That was the voice of Laura Blythe, the director of the Cherokee Historical Association and an enrolled member of the Eastern Band of Cherokee Indians.
So when we talk about it, we are the principal people, Ani Yung Wiyang, and we come from this earth. We were placed here. This is where we have called home since the beginning of time. So prior to contact, before Europeans came over, the Cherokee people were one of the largest tribes in the Southeast. We actually had territory in 8 different states. Say there needed to be a big decision made, and we had to call multiple towns together. They would send runners. You know, the Deer Clan were known as like the long distance runners, and sometimes they would fast and they would run up to 100 miles a day. All of the Cherokee Nation understood what was going on in surrounding areas.
I would say that that most all of the what is now the Appalachian Trail were used by Native peoples early on.
That's Lamar Marshall, a historian and land surveyor who has mapped the historic Cherokee footpaths that run throughout southern Appalachia.
Well, there were trails that, collateral trails, crossed the Appalachian Mountains at all the gaps and the passes, saddles, or whatever you want to call them. And sometimes the Native people would go up a trail to a gap, jump on what would eventually become the Appalachian Trail, and then follow that ridge to the next gap and drop off because that was feasible.
So once Europeans began to arrive, many changes began taking place. Trade and treaties started. Alliances with the French and British began. We had, you know, multiple smallpox epidemics. Treaties were made, which resulted in land loss. Wars resulted in towns being annihilated, and our Cherokee people and territory began to dwindle down over time.
When the white people moved into this area, they immediately took over the best Cherokee trails, which were in the valleys, and widened those trails into wagon roads. Cherokees still knew the backcountry. They knew these shortcuts across the gaps, and they followed these ridges from Cherokee, North Carolina, Aquala boundary, down to some where their friends lived in other ports, and they could stay out of the sight of white people by following these ridges. And that could have happened, you know, in sections of the Appalachian Trail also.
The lead up to the Revolutionary War was a chaotic period in history. The French and Indian War had just ended, and in its aftermath, the Cherokee Nation scored a big win against encroaching colonists and land prospectors.
The British, they created a proclamation boundary about 1763, and they said that no white settlement could take place over the crest of the Appalachian Mountains.
This proclamation boundary marked a crucial historical turning point. It fueled hope for many Native American communities, but it also stirred anger amongst many white settlers who were eager to push west across the continent. It's one of the factors that historians cite as an underlying cause of the American Revolution.
Did you know about this?
No.
My mom and I visited the Museum of the Cherokee People in Cherokee, North Carolina, which has an exhibit on the proclamation boundary of 1763.
When King George issued his proclamation forbidding whites to settle in the Appalachians and all parts west, we thought we would be safe. But then came the American Revolution.
Jesus. I had no idea.
Mm-hmm. It's one of those things that you don't learn in history classes in the U.S., like, on purpose.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Like, they don't teach that, and there's a reason why they don't teach that.
Already, the trail was shifting our perspective, and our journey had only just begun. We'll be back with more about the Appalachian Trail and Cherokee history after a short break. Hey there, adventurers. Are you ready to hit the trail this season? If so, check out Big Agnes, the mother of comfort. Whether you're backpacking, car camping, or sleeping under the stars in your backyard, Big Agnes gear is built for comfort without compromise. Their award-winning sleeping bags, pads, and tents are lightweight, durable, and feel like home, no matter where you roam. Say goodbye to cold, stiff nights, and hello to plush, cozy sleep in the wild or your backyard. Find Big Agnes at an outdoor retailer near you or at bigagnes.com and feel the difference. Big Agnes, comfort built for the backcountry. I'm Matt Podolsky. This is Common Land, a series about the Appalachian Trail.
The Revolutionary War was probably one of the major turning points. We were allied with the British during the American Revolution.
That's Laura Blythe, director of the Cherokee Historical Association and an enrolled member of the Eastern Band of Cherokee Indians.
The British told us they wouldn't take any more land from us. You know, if we had helped them win the war, then we would not have to give up any more land. Unfortunately, that did not happen.
The Cherokees were in a difficult position politically when the American Revolution came to an end. But remarkably, the Cherokee Nation continued to reinvent itself.
In 1808, the first Cherokee Constitution was created. In 1820, Sequoia created the Cherokee Syllabary. And within a year, 90% of Cherokee people were literate, reading and writing in our own language.
By the 1820s, it was clear that a Cherokee cultural renaissance was underway. Within just a few decades, the Cherokees had established a new government with their capital at New Echota in present-day Georgia. New Echota was the home of the Cherokee Supreme Court, as well as the Cherokee Phoenix newspaper, which was printed in both Cherokee and English.
Almost every major civilized capital in the world subscribed to the Cherokee Phoenix newspaper. Just how unique it was.
That's Lamar Sneed, the tribal chairman of the Georgia tribe of Eastern Cherokee.
I mean, they had trading systems. They actually had their own lawyers.
And then in 1828, gold was discovered in Georgia. The greed for gold is one of the biggest things that started the forced removal and the Trail of Tears.
Soon after gold was discovered in what is today northern Georgia, Andrew Jackson was elected president. Jackson's central campaign issue was Indian removal. He relentlessly campaigned in support of the forced removal of Native American people from the South.
In 1830, Andrew Jackson signed the Removal Act, and this was for multiple tribes in the area because they wanted to get rid of all the natives, get them off the land, so that the white settlers could have it and could get the gold from it and then have more area for themselves and their families to grow.
The Indian Removal Act gave the president authority to grant land west of the Mississippi in exchange for tribal homelands. But according to the act, these land exchanges were supposed to be mutual, based on treaties.
In 1835, a group of men at New Echota signed the Treaty of New Echota. And this treaty gave up what land we had left. It was signed without approval from the majority of the Cherokee people.
The Treaty of New Echota was not signed or endorsed by the Cherokee government. Most Cherokee citizens were opposed. Cherokee Principal Chief John Ross mounted a campaign in opposition, but the treaty was passed along to the U.S. Senate for a vote regardless.
All treaties have to be approved by the Senate. It passed the Senate by one vote.
In 1838, that was the year that the forced removal started taking place. U.S. troops were sent down and they started rounding people up out of their houses, started putting them into stockades with nothing more than what clothes they had on their backs.
They built 27 removal forts. Now, most people just hear about the Trail of Tears. No, it don't just start like that. You've got to round up people first.
Over the course of that year, out of 16,000 members, there were anywhere between 4,000 to 8,000 people who died.
Although a lot of the interviews you'll hear on this show were conducted after my hike, I had learned a lot about this history before I ever took a step on the Appalachian Trail, and I continued to conduct research while on the trail. I read books in my tent at night, listened to podcasts while I walked, and reached out to potential interviewees via email. Still, I struggled to visualize this history on the landscape. I was hiking through the mountains between Nuichota, the former Cherokee capital, and Dahlonega, the epicenter of the Georgia Gold Rush and also the site of one of the most infamous stockades. I know Cherokees there were detained under horrendous conditions and died in great numbers. Much of the Appalachian Trail is designed to be a quote-unquote wilderness experience. But the trail also provides opportunities to learn about history. There are lots of historical markers focused on early American history and the Civil War. Cherokee history doesn't get the same treatment. But just as I was struggling to imagine what it might look like to see a company of the US military walking through these woods, I crested a ridge and spotted two figures holding rifles in the woods ahead of me. At first, I thought they were hunters, but this wasn't hunting season, and I soon noticed the military-style camo. There was a full military company consisting of maybe 25 men in the woods alongside the trail. As my mom and I walked past, these men avoided our gaze, pretending we weren't there at all, as we walked right through their line of fire. Later that evening, after we had set up camp at a nearby shelter, it turns out the U.S. Army Ranger Program conducts training exercises throughout this area. A few of us hikers walked out towards a viewpoint where we could see the flashes of light from the blanks being fired over the next ridge.
They're just, in some respects, honestly play acting, because you treat it like it's real. You set up your perimeter, make sure everybody has interlocking fields of fire, but you're also looking around like, oh, that's the AT. So then it becomes like, okay, well, we just need to look like we're doing the right thing.
That's fellow thru-hiker
Andrew Paul Bagan,
but we'll call him Andy. A significant percentage of AT thru-hikers are former military, but Andy wasn't just a military veteran. He had gone through Army Ranger training in these same mountains just a few years earlier.
It's the hardest training I did in the Army, and it's the one that taught me the most, and also felt the most in line with what I thought I was getting into.
There was a lot of conversation in camp that night about the presence of the Army Ranger School, with hikers debating the appropriateness of conducting military training alongside the Appalachian Trail. Andy clearly had a unique perspective, and the next morning I asked him for an interview. We chatted while walking along the ridgeline of Sassafras Mountain in Georgia.
Actually, I'm glad that we had that experience, like, as a group, you know, like everybody, or a fair number of us saw these people, because one of the things I'm trying to work on is being more empathetic, you know, and really trying to better understand things from other people's viewpoints. So it was really interesting just to hear other people's unfiltered thoughts and concerns to what I took to be a very, especially because I had been on the opposite side of that, to be a fairly, you know, quotidian, I guess is a big word to use there, event.
I do have a lot of experience around guns, and I hunt, and I grew up being taught about gun safety. It's just been hammered into my brain since I was a kid that you don't point a gun at another human being. It doesn't matter if it's loaded or not loaded or blanks or not blanks. For me, it would have been a completely different experience if those guns weren't aimed directly at the trail where people were passing by.
Well, when we do force on force stuff, you know, you're shooting at people with these blanks. And I guess for me, you just get so used to that. It's like, okay, as long as I'm not within like 3 feet or whatever of this thing, then I'm okay. You're just doing what's been drilled into you, which is, all right, face out, pull security. You're not even thinking about, oh, maybe they're spooked by this. And I think when I was going through it, I just assumed everybody knew about it, you know? Yeah. Knew that, like, hey, this is a possibility, this is, you might see it. So I didn't think, especially when I was in it, I didn't think too deeply about it.
You said you occasionally would walk along the Appalachian Trail.
We didn't encounter that many people, honestly. Okay. 5 to 10 at most. Okay. I was pulling security while we were tearing down this tent. It's nice. Old lady comes by. And I wasn't about to be like super off-putting because she looked like my grandma. So I was like, hi, how are you today, ma'am? Or I didn't like that.
So you got in trouble for saying hello to some nice old lady?
A little bit. But I thought I was building civil military relations, you know, winning hearts and minds.
Day 12, April 8th. It's a bit cold, but beautiful when we wake up. Someone checks the weather forecast on their phone as we're getting ready. It says that there's a 50% chance of rain. We're skeptical. There's not a cloud in the sky when we start hiking.
When that was recorded, I lay wrapped up in my warm sleeping bag as snow pelted the thin sides of my tent. We had entered the mountains of North Carolina earlier that day and were greeted by a snowstorm.
All right. Well, we made it to the North Carolina-Georgia border, and it started to snow.
Cheers.
What began as a light scattering of snowflakes soon transformed into a heavy snowfall. Thick white flakes fell from the sky. We stopped to put on our rain jackets, now wearing every article of clothing that we had brought with us.
Look at these giant snowflakes. Hiking in the snow.
You gotta do it.
By the time we reached Standing Indian Shelter, where we planned to spend the night, there were several inches of snow on the ground, and temperatures had dropped well below freezing. With frozen fingers and shivering bodies, we set up our tents. Then we stood around the campfire with a group of fellow hikers and quickly shoveled down our dinner before finally crawling into our warm sleeping bags.
The windbreak provided by the tent warms me almost immediately. It's not that late now, almost 8 p.m., but I'm exhausted. Our plans for tomorrow are now uncertain, as neither of us want to hike another 12 miles in the snow. We'll just have to wait and see what the new day brings.
Standing Indian Mountain was the tallest peak we had ascended thus far, and by the time we stood on its summit, we were warm from the exertion of the climb. Soon, the sun would emerge from the clouds, and we enjoyed a magical day on trail, hiking through a landscape transformed by a thick blanket of snow. It had taken us 12 days to hike 86 miles through northern Georgia, the heart of the former Cherokee Nation. In our next episode, my mom and I reached the highest peak on the entire Appalachian Trail.
Well, this is as high up as we'll get on the whole trail.
And we'll dig into more of the overlapping history between the Appalachian Trail and the Cherokee Nation.
Nobody in my age group right now, at 71 years old, can climb these mountains like I can. They can't take you there. There's just time's running out.
Common Land is a production of the Wildlands Collective. This season was produced in partnership with New Hampshire Public Radio. This episode was produced by me, your host, Matt Podolsky. Music is by Blue Dot Sessions. To listen to the next episode in the series, just search for Common Land in Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. To learn more about the show and to see a full list of credits, go to commonlandpodcast.com.